All right, we are on week three of our study of apologetics. Last week, if you remember, we covered the Kalam cosmological argument and the teleological argument. And you can kind of see the premises and the conclusion. The Kalam cosmological argument is the argument from the beginning of the universe, essentially saying the universe began to exist, everything that begins to exist has a cause, therefore the universe has a cause. And as Tom has memorized, the cause was spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, and singular. The teleological argument, we looked at examples of how the universe is fine-tuned for life. For example, if the force of gravity was off by 1 in 10 to the 40th power, that's a 1 with 40 zeros behind it, the sun would not exist. And there's about a dozen or so facts about the state of the universe that are astronomically low odds. And then we looked at why the best explanation of that fine-tuning is intelligent design. This week, we are going to look at our final two arguments. We're only going to look at four, known as the moral argument and the argument from information. There's more than one. So I said last week how the Kalam was kind of my favorite, and the teleological is considered by some atheists to be the best. But the moral argument might be the most relevant, and it's often the most useful in bringing people to Jesus, and it's definitely the most emotionally charged argument. So I really hope that we can grasp the ins and the outs of this argument, because once you understand how it works, you can begin to apply it in different areas and different conversations, and it becomes very relevant. And as I said, we are going to cover just one of the arguments from information today. There's a lot of similar arguments to it, like arguments from mathematics and laws of nature, but we're going to look at just one. And I'd like to remind you of the three goals we have for this class. That being, one, learning to love the Lord our God with our mind, meaning intellectually. Two, to be better equipped to fulfill the command and follow the example of apologetics in Scripture. And three, to be better prepared for trials that come about in our own life. So then we're going to begin with the moral argument. As I said, this is kind of the most relevant argument to be used in dealing with unbelievers. I've mentioned this guy before. He's one of my favorite authors and speakers. His name is Frank Turek. He estimated that about 80% of the questions or objections that he fields are moral ones and deal with morality in some sense. So that's four-fifths of the questions are kind of dealing with morality. These objections come in many different forms, such as how does a loving God send people to hell, or the atrocities committed by God in the Old Testament are just make him a moral monster. Or Christianity may be true for you, but it's not true for me. And so the moral argument can help you deal with all of those things. It covers a wide range of things. And as I said, it is the most emotionally charged. It hits the core of who humans are. They want to live their own way and not be told they're wrong. I know I don't like to be told I'm wrong. So naturally, people are not going to be fans of you saying there's an objective moral standard that you ought to follow. So the argument kind of goes like this. Morality is known through rationale and reasoning. So, and then I'll just read through it. And then premise two, moral values and duties are objective and independent of human minds. Thus, moral values must be grounded in a non-human, unchanging, and rational mind. We call this unchanging rational mind God. That might seem very complex at first, but we're going to break it down. And I want you to know, there are many different ways to phrase the moral argument. This is just the particular one that I chose because I found these premises the easiest to support. So the first premise, morality is known through a rational process, is relatively uncontested amongst many people. We don't conduct experiments to know what's right and wrong. You can look at somebody mistreating somebody else and know that's wrong. Or you can feel somebody mistreating you and say, yeah, that doesn't feel right. That has to be wrong. And so we come to know morality through reasoning or rationale. That's how we kind of know right and wrong. And we'll get more into that. That aligns with Scripture as well. Now we get to that second premise that moral values and duties are objective and independent of human minds. By objective, I mean it applies to all humans, and independent of human minds, I mean it transcends or is outside of a human mind. It's not dependent. Now, no human decided what these laws are. They're outside of any human's decision. So this is the most contested premise. If somebody's going to object to it, they're going to object to this one. So how many of you know a man by the name of C.S. Lewis? Kind of figured he's a pretty famous guy. So C.S. Lewis, if you don't know, he authored the books The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And he was a former atheist turned Christian. And he actually had a movie out about him. Well, he's dead now. But he had a movie out called The Reluctant Convert. You should check it out. And he was invited to deal with the problems of pain, evil, and suffering on the BBC radio during World War II. And so he delivered many talks on the BBC radio from about 1942 to about 1944, and they were compiled into a book called Mere Christianity, which I have a copy of and I highly recommend. It's a great book. The book starts with the first talk that he delivered. And in it, Lewis notes that we can learn a lot about humans and their morality by listening to them argue or quarrel. And so he said, you might hear someone say, well, how do you like it if I did the same thing that you did to me, if I did that to you? Or, that's my seat, I was here first. Or, give me some of your food, I shared my food with you. Or, come on, you promised you should do this for me. When someone says these things, he's not merely saying he doesn't like the other person's behavior or that it doesn't please him. He's appealing to some sort of standard by which he's calling the other person's actions wrong. He's not just complaining. He's saying you're wrong, and he's appealing to some sort of standard outside of himself to say that, whether he realizes it or not. When the person who's accused of being wrong responds, they typically don't say, the heck with your standard, you know, I don't think lying is wrong, or I don't think cheating is wrong, or I don't think not keeping my promises is wrong. Instead, they try to make some special reason or some excuse as to why in this particular case, what they did excused their action. They might say something like, oh, well, it was different when you gave me food, so I don't have to give you mine now. Or, if I would have known things would have turned out this way, I wouldn't have promised you that. They make some sort of excuse to get around the standard. But by making the excuse, they're confessing that they also agree with this standard. And so Lewis noted in the beginning of Mere Christianity that both parties subconsciously seem to have a standard of right or wrong, or as Lewis put it, a rule of fair play that they already agree upon when they come to these things. There's no sense in trying to tell someone their actions were wrong if there isn't an agreement between what right and wrong is. It'd be playing football without any rules. It doesn't really make any sense. Does that make sense to people? Does that make sense to all of you? Did I explain that well? Okay. So children even know right and wrong at a young age. And so it seems as if morality was placed within children or humans at a very young age. I mean, if a child hits another child, that child knows that's not right and he wants to retaliate. So at a very young age, we know right and wrong, and that's not something that's kind of learned. It's kind of placed in there. And obviously, we would say that's placed in there by God. If you didn't catch that, that's kind of where I'm going. So to turn your Bibles to Romans 2. So when somebody gets to Romans 2, could you please read verses 14 and 15? Now, would somebody like to give their understanding or explanation of these two verses that we just read? What do you think these two verses mean? Yes. Right. And so despite that not having the written law of God, verse 15 says that they still do the things in the law by nature. And verse 15 says that because they do those things of the law by nature, they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing with them. So here's an example that even though God did not give his written law, to all people. It was just given to the Jews. He still had a moral law inscribed on the heart of every man, including Gentiles. And they knew by nature the things in the law and did them. And so this is where we kind of get this concept that God writes his moral law and the idea of what is right and wrong on the heart of every man. And so as Christians, we would agree with kind of everything that Lewis laid out and that I said. So the moral law, or this rule of fair play, isn't like other laws of nature or laws of logic. For example, if I were to jump, I don't have any choice as to whether I'm coming back to the ground or not. Okay? I'm coming back down whether I like it or not. And as much as I would like to jump higher, I can't jump any higher. So I'm coming back down whether I like it or not. But the moral law isn't like this, because I get a decision as to whether I'm going to obey the moral law. I don't get a decision as to whether I'm going to obey the law of gravity. The law of gravity just acts and I come back down. But with the law of morality, I get a decision to make, and I get to choose whether I obey this law or not. And so while the law of gravity might describe what happens, the moral law prescribes what ought to happen. And this is very different than anything else we have. And so it's very hard to get an ought, you ought to do something this way, from just a law of nature. That usually involves an agent. And so this is kind of where this argument trends. So because I have a choice to obey the moral law or not, and it's prescribed for me to do so, it's prescribed that I ought to do something, it's different. And so, as we know, laws have lawgivers, and prescriptions have prescribers. And prescriptions happen between two agents. So if I have this law of morality that I look, that I have on my heart, and I'm looking around like Lewis did, and I'm seeing it written on the hearts of man, and how they seem to agree on this law of right and wrong, and I see that, and I see this is prescribed for us to do because we have a choice to act in it, then I know there must be a prescriber out there that's given me this moral law, which leads to our final premise, or third premise, that these truths must be grounded in an unchanging and rational mind. So because if you look at the first one, how we said morality is known through rationale and reasoning, we don't like conduct experiments to know what's wrong. We don't have to torture babies to know that that's inherently wrong. We just kind of know it and we can reason through it. Because they're understood through rationale and reasoning, moral laws themselves must be grounded in a rational mind and not something inanimate or innate like nature or the universe. They have to be grounded in a mind. And because moral laws are objective, as Lewis laid out, and are true independent of each human's opinion and mind, moral truths must be grounded in something that's not a human mind. And because moral truths are objective and they're unchanging, they've been the same, you know, Hitler was wrong 80 years ago, you know, the Romans were wrong 2,000 years ago with a lot of the things they did. The same moral laws are unchanging throughout history. And therefore, they must be in an unchanging mind. And so we get this thing that's like an unchanging and rational mind that's beyond a human mind. And this mind is something that we call God. And so therefore, it would follow that God exists, or there's a rational, unchanging mind that has grounded morality in all of us.
But that, you're speaking of the ultimate moralities. Hitler thought that everything he was doing was perfectly moral, and he just went with it. These people are not human beings, I can put them to death. And then his soldiers carried the stuff out. So our morality, there's certainly God's morality that you just read there in Romans 2, but man's thinking just sets it aside, and he sets up his own morality. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, not every man did what was right in God's eyes. That was the end of Judges. So anybody can come up with a morality, a godly morality. I mean, morality is known through rationale and reason. Well, the Romans, any of these groups, us now, with the gripes that are going on in our country now, our morality is changing all the time. It's so you're basing it on the ultimate morality of God that he built within us, which every one of us has turned aside from and wants our own morality.
But this is where you're going. This is the point of premise, too. If we're in conversation with people in the world and understand that moral values are outside of ourselves, we have a discussion point. Where does that come from? What makes Hitler wrong? Because if everybody can set morality aside, just decide what is right or wrong, because I want to decide what is right or wrong, then Hitler wasn't wrong. And nobody wants to hear that. But if we can solidify the premise two, then that's where the discussion comes from. Because we have to understand, well, just because I think Hitler was wrong, Hitler didn't think he was wrong. So the judgment comes from something outside of ourselves. And what is that that's outside of ourselves, that's unchanging, that's rational, that is set out in concrete, and it is that standard by which our morality is made?
So I actually listened to the speaker I mentioned earlier, Frank Turk, was giving a question or having a Q&A session, and an atheist came to the microphone and was talking about morality. And Frank asked him, if the Nazis had won World War II and had taken over America and implemented their policies, and everybody was doing what the Nazis did, would it still be wrong? And the atheist sat there and said, well, yeah, it would still be wrong. And he goes, well, why would it still be wrong? Because this particular atheist had said, well, how we decide what is moral and unmoral is, or immoral, is we kind of get together in a group and we decide as a society. And every society has their own morality and they decide what's right for them. You know, way back when we were evolving in Africa, we had different tribes and each tribe would have developed their own morality. And now we just develop our own morality as societies. And so Frank asked him, well, would it still be wrong if the Nazis had won World War II? And this atheist had said, well, yeah, it would still be wrong. Or because they lost World War II, why was Hitler wrong? As absurd as that question sounds, on what basis do we have to prosecute the Nazis for war crimes? Because if that view of morality is correct, where each society sets up their own morality, then we have no basis to say that Nazi Germany was in the wrong because they were doing the right by their own morality. And so you can't accuse them of being wrong unless there's an objective standard that transcends all nations that you can appeal to and say, yeah, that was wrong. Does that make sense?
So did he convince the atheist?
Yeah. Does that make sense? Everybody got that? We're going to get to that in a second, because that's a self-defeating claim if you really think about it. Is it true for you that it's true for you and not for me? See, if somebody says, well, that's true for you, but not for me, you can say, well, the fact that it's true for you, but not for me, is true for you, but not for me. It's a self-defeating claim. If somebody says, you know, there is no truth, is that a true statement? Or truth doesn't exist, is that a true statement? It's just a self-defeating claim. And right, right. And when you recognize a self-defeating claim like that, you can point it out. So, yeah, the most common objections to this, Jeffrey. Okay, well, the most common objections, I'm not going to get into like all of them because that would take way too much time. The moral argument does not claim that atheists cannot be moral people. That's often the most common confusion, is that somebody will say, well, atheists can be moral. We don't need God to be moral. That is true. You don't need God to live a good life. You need God to understand why morality exists, not to live a good life. And that's an important distinction to make. And you don't need everyone to agree on morality for morality to be objective. That's another thing you don't need. And so those are two kind of objections or misunderstandings of the argument. People will try and say that evolution explains morality, but what was your... How would I define an ultimate right?
Okay, the moral argument says that there is moral values that can be subjective that are independent of human nature. What are those moral values? Okay, to say that, fine. Okay, but what are they? How does that get defined? Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question. And this is a common objection you actually hear. What moral values are, or how we come to know them, is different than justifying them. How I come to know morality is an epistemological claim. Things about the nature of morality is an ontological claim. And so epistemologically, it's a different question to say, how do I come to know what these moral values and duties are? That's much different than saying, how do I come to justify why these moral values and duties exist? Do you see the kind of, like, bifurcation there?
Define epistemology.
So, okay, I'm sorry. So epistemology is how we come to know something. Ontology is the nature or the study of something. And so Jeffrey's asking a question about how we come to know morality, and the moral argument, when it's worded this way, is meant to not involve itself with that. The moral argument deals with how do we justify morality existing, which is different than how we come to know what morality is. Does that make sense? Because we can come to know what morality is completely and apart from God. I don't think we have to appeal to God to know right and wrong, because I think Romans 2, he's written it on our hearts, and we just inherently know that murder is wrong. But I think to justify why murder is wrong, or why I shouldn't kill my neighbor for my own profit, I think you have to appeal to a standard outside of yourself. And I think that's two different questions. Does that make sense to everybody? Did I explain that in little words? Krista?
I think you have to go back to your Romans 2 passage. God's morality, whether we like it or not, is written within us. Whether we're a Jew or a Gentile, it makes no difference. Now, and that's the final statement about God's righteous morality. What we do with that, and how we, if we're not a Christian, you can be an atheist and make up your own rules, or you can be a Muslim and Allah is dictating the rules, which are different than ours. That's where man is beginning to do what's right in his own eyes, as opposed to this is what God said. Built within us, as you said, murder is wrong. But what about the guy in the subway who ended up killing the guy because he was threatening people? He was doing it to save the other people, apparently, you know. So,
well, then you start getting into moral dilemmas, and then that's a completely different thing. But for the moral argument to actually run and to actually work, you don't need everyone in the world to agree on what these moral things are. It's just that they exist. You don't need everybody to agree on it. And in my experience, if you're in a room arguing that Hitler wasn't necessarily wrong, you're probably going to lose that argument. And
depends on which room you're in. If you look at the world today, there are a lot of things that people agree with that 50 years ago would have been meaningful to most people in the world. But the window has moved, and you know, morality has what we believe is moral has changed drastically. So it gets a little muddy to me. That's all. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying.
So you said how morality has seemed to change over the past 50 years. Okay. What were you going to say? Right.
They're going to react negatively to that. So the average person does understand what you're saying in terms of moral law. Yeah, there's leaders that are saying, yeah, you go and kill the infidel and you'll get, you know, virgins in heaven and all that kind of stuff. I get that. But to me, that just shows, and to me it's interesting at how evil, and I do think that what we're looking at in the world here is not a matter of politics, it's a matter of good and evil. I think it's Satan and God having his battle in the heavenly places. I think it's good and evil. I don't think it's political. We can talk political in this nation, but I think it's good and evil. But it shows how hard evil works against that understanding we have of moral right and wrong that everybody has. So it shows me the prevalence of evil and the strength of evil, and how much the forces aligned against our God are going to work at changing our values in what we understand.
Right, and part of that point, like Jeffrey was saying, how we come to know morality is when we know something is done to us. But I wanted to come back to Chris's point, because this is an objection that's kind of been raised. You know, morality changes, and therefore it's not objective. Oftentimes when you hear progressives or people who, you know, we're now more accepting of the LGBTQ community, you know, and we're progressing towards a better, more moral society. Is that fair to say that despite those changes, the people who are making those changes think we're making them in the right direction? And you would think we're making them in the wrong direction. why are we progressing morally in the wrong direction? See, if they're going to say we're progressing in the right direction, and you're saying, well, we're changing and we're progressing in the wrong direction, you're appealing to a standard to say, oh, we're getting closer to that standard, or we're getting farther away from that standard. So though we're changing, you're saying those changes are bad because it's getting worse. Why is it getting worse? Without an objective standard of morality, you can't say it's getting worse. All you can say it's changing. Without an objective standard of morality, you can't say we're making progress. We're just changing. Does that make sense? And you could phrase these premises and word them and put them in ways where it could fit to something that you could defend better. I would come back to say that those questions, while dealing with morality, don't necessarily pertain to this argument. And we are going to spend an entire week on the problems of evil, pain, and suffering and how we deal with that and how we reconcile a loving God with evil, pain, and suffering. But to your point, you can use this argument to help answer those questions. But if you come across an atheist who has a standard of morality, from then you're just reasoning, well, where do you get this standard from? Or if you come across somebody who doesn't have a standard of morality, then you got to start one step farther back and say, well, how do you justify anything being right and wrong if there isn't a standard? And once you get to a standard, you get to God. And so that's the point of the argument. It isn't necessarily to answer all those questions. And we will get to those questions in week six, I think.
Just real quick, I mean, if you just cut it to the atheist versus the believers, I've seen enough in debates, they cannot come up with an answer. They lose the debate every time. Because if there is no God, there is no morality, and that we each do what we want to, what we think is our own morality. When you ask an atheist, where does that morality come from? And they can't answer. We can answer it as believers. Our morality comes from the Bible, from God. It's instilled in us. But an atheist will never be able to answer that Hitler's wrong or right. They lose the argument. That's what I'm saying. So you can easily defeat that argument by just saying, if you don't believe in, you know, our morals come from the Bible, from God. If you don't believe in God and the Bible, then there is no morality. And you can, you know, we just came from some swine. Then there's nothing wrong with me shooting you right in the head right now. As an atheist, what's wrong with that? You know, I'm just saying, it's an easily, to me, it's in my mind, it's easily defeated. The atheist does not have a leg to stand on when it comes to where morality comes from, if they don't believe in it.
Because you have to have an objective standard of morality, and that objective standard in morality has to be grounded in a rational mind, and that rational mind we call God. That's another way to put the argument.
Yes, that's it.
And so you just have to get somebody to come to believe in a standard and show that if they don't believe in a standard, why that doesn't make any sense. Because then you can't call Hitler wrong. Then you can't say we aren't making any moral progress as a society if there is no standard outside of ourselves.
We use the same standard. Why is rape wrong? Why is pedophilia wrong? Why is abortion wrong? It's not wrong. Why can't you do it to any of us? Unless you have God.
People say they're wrong.
What? Yes.
Again, we have to realize the morality, the ultimate morality is built within us. God puts it there. That's why every human being knows it basically. And every human being, as it says in Romans 1:18, suppresses that truth. And then in verse 32, although they know the ordinance of God, that means every human being, you know, it's not from Scripture, it's from God. Though they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. That's where every human being has it built within them by God. And when you go to the atheist, and he goes, well, I don't know where it comes from. I just know mom and dad taught me that. Or fill in the blank of where he thinks that murder is wrong, just using the ultimate murder is wrong. We say, I don't care what's built within me. I'm going to kill that guy because I want his stuff, period. You know, knowing what's evil, we turn aside intentionally and do that and give hearty approval to that which is evil. That's mankind.
Yes. So I think, does everybody kind of get that we appeal to a standard beyond ourselves when we talk about morality? And that standard has to be grounded in a being or a mind that's bigger than ourselves. And so the fact that we have a standard written on our hearts points to there being a being beyond us. So we are not going to get to the second argument today. But real quick, I just wanted to cover, this is kind of like a side little tangent, but I wanted to cover how God being the moral standard points to his triune nature. So can we all agree that love is a good moral action? That loving someone else is a good moral action? Right? So God being the perfect moral standard would be the perfection of loving someone else. Correct? Okay? So how does God love someone else before he creates the world and there is no one else to love? Because love, the good moral action of loving someone else, necessitates that there be two persons involved. Because you can't love someone else if there is no one else to love. And so if God is going to be morally perfect and loving before he creates any persons, it would seem as if there's a plurality in the nature of God, and that there's an eternal love between the three co-equal, co-eternal persons of the Godhead. Does that make sense? I just thought that was a cool little nugget that I could throw in here with this.
Well, you need at least two.
Not to confuse it. Are there any questions? Because we kind of went all over the place today, and we're talking a lot. Does anybody have, like, any questions? We have a couple minutes. I'm not going to get into the second one. We'll start that next week. Nope. Oh, yeah, I'll be away next week. 2 weeks. You get to wait a little longer. We're going to talk about an argument from information, how there's 3 billion characters in a single cell, and how that information points to there being a designer. That's where we're going to go. Then we're going to start with we can probably start that 2 weeks. Start with some the most popular common objections you're going to hear to God's existence. We'll begin to deal with arguments against God's existence as we've been kind of going through the arguments for God's existence. So that's where we'll kind of start next week, and I'm ending on time.